Hello, lovelies. My name is Caitlin, and welcome to another episode of True Crime with Caitlin. Today, I'm going to take you all on a journey over the pond, covering my very first international case here on the podcast. This is one of Sweden's most notorious murder, in which the killer was dubbed the Atlas Vampire. Today, I'm going to tell you all about the unsolved murder of Lily Lindström. Near the southwestern tip of Sweden lies Malmö, which is the third largest city in Sweden. Throughout this episode, there are a couple of Swedish words which I have tried my very best to pronounce correctly, but if I haven't done so, I apologise in advance. Here in Malmö resided Franz and Tilda Larsson, who on the 29th of August 1900 gave birth to their first child, a little girl they named Lily Elizabeth Larsson. 4 years later, Franz and Tilda continued growing their family. They would end up having 10 children in total, their youngest being born when Lily was 22. Growing up, Lily was described as a cheery girl who always managed to put a smile on your face. She had a knack for making people laugh and was very caring by nature. She married young, marrying a local merchant who gave her the surname Lindström, but their relationship didn't last long. They would eventually end up divorcing. With no husband, no children, and absolutely nothing holding her back, 22-year-old Lily decided to up and move almost 400 miles away, going to Stockholm, Sweden. At the time, Stockholm was somewhere that offered a lot of work opportunities with its booming industries. It was jam-packed with brand new bars and restaurants, there were all different types of interesting people, and it was just where all of the buzz was at the time. It remained like that for almost a decade, up until the crash of the stock market triggered the Great Depression. Suddenly, people were struggling to live and make ends meet, crime rates began to heighten, and for many people all over the world, this was a dreadful time, and Lily was no exception. She had begun struggling financially, and so in order to keep herself afloat and support herself, she began doing sex work in April 1931. Slowly but surely, Lily was able to get back on her feet, and in fact, she began to do really well for herself. She lived in a flat in the Atlas region of Stockholm, and I believe that the block she lived in at 11 St. Eric Plaza was relatively new. The flats inside here weren't luxurious by any means, but it was ample for Lily. They were small and dark, often consisting of one to two box bedrooms, a kitchenette, a small living room, and a private bathroom, which was considered an amenity, not a necessity at the time. Because they were newer buildings, they also came with central heating, which was perfect for the cold Swedish winters. Sometimes the temperature could drop right down to minus 20 degrees, so it was absolutely freezing. Lily's flat wasn't decked out with loads of extravagant furniture. She really only had the very basics, but it was enough for what a single young woman needed. Because she had been very careful with her cash, Lily was eventually able to splash out and treat herself when she wanted. She wore beautiful, expensive clothes, always looking her best. She really looked after herself. I guess this was part of her job, really, because the more desirable she was, the more clients she would attract. Lily owned a radio, which was very rare because they were super expensive. This made her very popular within the apartment block, and she would also be the first person in the entire block that owned their own house phone. Because of this, she was nicknamed the Call Girl. Lily used having a house phone to her advantage. Sex work was and still is a dangerous job, as you never really know who the client is or what their actual intentions are. So now she has the ability to be contacted over the phone. Lily decided that she was no longer going to be standing in the streets or hoping to find a client in the back of a bar. She could arrange to have the clients ring her if they wanted to book an appointment with her. Now that she's quite comfortable financially, she's also able to be picky when it comes to clients, not accepting every Tom, Dick and Harry, and she was even able to not work for a couple of days if she fancied. So now she begins to feel a whole lot safer and in control with her work. Two other sex workers who also lived in her apartment block would use the phone for the same reason. Lily was happy to allow them to do so, just because it was a bit more safer. The 30th of April 1932 was an exciting day for 31-year-old Lily. She had plans to go to nearby Yure Gordon to celebrate the annual Walpurgis Night. So I looked into what that was because I had never heard of it before and it sounds so nice. So, Walpurgis Night is on the 30th of April every year, dating right back to the 18th century, and it's celebrated mostly in the north of Europe and Scandinavia. So what they're doing is celebrating and welcoming the start of spring season and the end of the winter season. Typically, bonfires are lit, people sing traditional folk songs, local celebrities do speeches, there's lots of food and alcohol flowing, and the main event is a huge explosion of vivid fireworks. Traditionally, I believe this celebration was also in part to ward off evil spirits and witchcraft, although like I say, now it's more about welcoming springtime. How nice does that sound? I would love to experience something like that. They don't do like anything like that in the north of England where I'm from. So, on this day in 1932, Lily is excited to go and celebrate. She and her friend, 35-year-old Minnie Jansen, were sat inside of her flat, Lily's flat, discussing how they thought the evening was going to go, anticipating who they were going to see, what they wanted to wear, how they wanted to wear their hair, etc. The two women are sat chatting when Lily's phone begins to ring at around 6:30 p.m. Minnie leaned over trying to listen in to the caller and she recalled the conversation going like this, but please bear in mind that this is translated so it may not be 100% exact words. Is that Miss Lindstrom? Yes, it is. Are you home if I come to visit? Of course I'm home. You can hear that. Lily found that question quite amusing. Obviously she was home. He was ringing her house phone and she answered it. Can you receive me if I come in a while? Yes. Are you far away? No, I'm very close. I'm coming soon. Neither Lily nor Minnie recognised the voice of the man on the phone, which on its face felt off, but I guess they didn't deep it too much. See, Lily had a bit of paper with her phone number on it, her number being VASA10422. She would leave this bit of paper beside her phone, and if she had a client over that she liked or trusted or felt comfortable with, she would let them write her number down for future work. But if she had a client that she had met in a bar or a restaurant or a hotel or wherever and she took him back but she didn't care to see him again, she would hide the paper so that he couldn't contact her again. So it felt a bit weird that neither of the women recognised this man's voice, but because he seemed a quote, well-behaved, nice, sober gentleman, Lily didn't think into it too much. He must have got her phone number somehow. Minnie was also a sex worker, so she knew that now it was her cue to go so that Lily could prepare for her client coming. She left the flat and took a stroll to a nearby shop to collect some milk before making her way back to the building. Minnie also lived at 11 St. Eric Plaza, but she was on one of the floors below Lily. I don't know if she was directly below Lily, but she was on a lower level than her. A short time after arriving back home at around 7 p.m, Minnie got a knock on her door from Lily asking if she could borrow a condom. This was like a secret code that the woman had made just to tell the other one that they were all right. Lily confirmed that the client who arrived was the man who had been on the phone, and she seemed in high spirits. She was chirpy. Minnie recalls that whistling as she ascended the stairs back to her flat. Lily would come back one more time, this time genuinely needing to borrow more condoms, and she was naked, bar a coat and some black boots. 9 p.m. soon rolled around and Minnie was ready to go out for Walpurgis Night. She went upstairs to grab Lily, knocking on her door sometime between 9 p.m. and 10 p.m, but got no answer. Assuming that Lily had gone elsewhere with her client or had already left for the celebrations, Minnie shrugged and made her own way out. Between cheap drinks and blaring music, Minnie kept an eye out for her friend Lily around the scorching bonfire, but she was nowhere to be seen. When she returned back home, she again went to check on Lily, but to no avail, she wasn't answering the door. Off the bat, Minnie wasn't worried or panicking or anything like that. It wouldn't be unusual for Lily to have gone out with her client, either to a restaurant or a hotel or wherever, maybe somewhere else to celebrate Walpurgis Night. So Minnie just assumed that that's what it was and left it at that, going home and going to bed. As the days went on, Minnie's concern did begin to grow. Lily had dropped out of going to the Walpurgis Night celebrations with her, which she was so excited for, and now Minnie hasn't heard from her or seen her in days, which was really unusual. Lily was partial to popping in and seeing her friends and chit-chatting over a cup of coffee, especially if she had had an exciting night. Being a good friend, Minnie began to investigate. She spoke with the landlords of the building, a woman named Ruth Johnson, and her husband. They said that they had seen Lily on the 30th of April. She arrived to their flat, paying her rent for the upcoming month of May. She and Ruth sat, had a cup of coffee before going out to buy some flowers. Lily had invited both Ruth and her husband down to her flat on that evening, as there was a special variety broadcast being broadcasted on the radio for Walpurgis Night. So they were all going to sit, have a couple of drinks and listen to this while preparing to go out for the bonfire. Ruth and her husband were really excited for this. They didn't own a radio, so this was something that they had never done before. So they promptly arrived at Lily's door at 9:30 p.m, which was their arranged time. But Lily didn't answer. Presuming that she had already left or forgotten about their plans, Ruth and her husband just went back to their flat. Minnie then spoke to a man who I couldn't find the name of. This man was a mutual friend of the women, and he too had struggled to get in contact with Lily. Finally, Minnie went to the flat of a woman named Emma, who, again, Emma was another mutual friend. Emma echoed what everybody else had said. No, she hadn't seen Lily, and no, she hadn't spoken to her. In fact, she and Lily had made plans for the 2nd of May, which by now had already passed, and Lily just didn't show, which was really out of character for her. She very rarely ever cancelled plans full stop, but she had never, ever, ever just dropped someone in it in the last minute, especially without telling them. The group of everyone who I just mentioned made their way to Lily's flat and brayed on the door, calling out her name, telling her to open up, but unsurprisingly, there was no response. Someone from the group had tried calling Lily over and over and over, and she wasn't picking up. Again, this was unusual because really, this is Lily's work phone. If she was for some reason wanting to ignore her friends, wanting a bit of space, she could ignore them, but why would she ignore a work call? Of course, back then, these are really old telephones, so there's no sort of caller ID, so Lily can't look at the phone and be like, oh, that's Minnie ringing, I'm gonna ignore her, and then be like, oh, this is a work call, I'll answer that. There was no way of seeing which was which. And so now, feeling like there was no other option, Minnie walked to the closest police station and relayed her concerns onto the officers. On the 4th of May 1932, Officer Nordstrom arrived to 11 St. Eric Plaza building to try and check up on Lily to see what was going on. This is now the fourth day that no one has heard or seen from her. Officer Nordstrom knocks on the door and patiently waits. He presses his ear against the door and is met with silence. He leans down onto his knees and lifts open Lily's letterbox, noticing that there's a light on inside. He tries a final time to knock and call out for Lily, but when she doesn't answer, he proceeds to contact the fire department, who aid him in breaking the door down to get inside. Once the door is off its hinges, there is an eerie silence inside of the dark flat. Officer Nordstrom walks inside, past the bathroom, through to the living room, and that is where he would find the corpse of Lily Linderstrom. Lily was found lay on a ottoman. She was on her left side with her left arm stretched above her head, which was face down on the ottoman, and she also had pillows piled on top of her. She was found completely naked, bar the black boots that Minnie had saw her wearing. It was immediately clear that 31-year-old Lily was dead. Lily's body would be removed from the flat and sent for autopsy. District Police Physician Dr. Turnell found that Lily had sustained 3 severe wounds to the back right-hand side of her head, which had caved in her skull. He believed that an instrument such as a pipe or crowbar or something similar in weight and length was the weapon used to strike Lily. The fatal wound, which Dr. Turnell believed was the first of the three, stretched right from Lily's temple all the way down to her neck. This would have killed her pretty much instantly. It was determined that Lily had been struck from behind while in the middle of sexual intercourse. This theory came from a condom being found still inside of her body. After murdering Lily, her killer would go on to ejaculate all across her. Maybe he got some sort of sick sexual thrill from it. Saliva was also present in several places on Lily's body, predominantly around her neck, and shockingly, almost all of Lily's blood had been completely drained from her body. How? Was a mystery. There was no puncture wound or anything on her body that showed how almost 5 liters of blood was extracted from her. Of course, she had the extensive wounds to her head, but those wouldn't cause her blood to completely drain. Back at the scene, nothing seemed out of place. This told the investigators that there was no obvious sign of a struggle, and that would line up with the theory that Lily was unknowingly attacked from behind, that she had no opportunity to fight back. Despite Lily being completely drained of blood, the flat was pretty much spotless. There was a tiny amount of drip blood, which had already dried, and a bloody tea towel found inside of the kitchen, but that was it. The amount of blood found from the dried drip blood and on the bloody tea towel wouldn't equate to how much blood that Lily had lost. So how was the flat completely spotless? If you imagine inflicting an injury, usually blood can pour or spray or splatter, but again, Lily only had the injuries to her head, no other ones to explain how her blood was drained, and nowhere in the flat showed which room or where her blood was drained. Or even really that her blood had been drained. I mean, looking at the flat, if you know that someone's blood has been drained, you could expect pools of blood on the floor or some on the walls or even more than just kind of little specks, but there was none of that. The only reason that we know Lily's blood was drained was because of her autopsy. So how had the killer done this, something seemingly impossible? This question, which is still unanswered, paired with the saliva found around Lily's neck, would later contribute to the theory that her killer was a vampire. After her body was removed, Lily's friends were allowed to go into the flat to see if anything was stolen or if anything stood out to them. As I mentioned, the women would often spend a lot of time in each other's flats, so if something didn't look right, they would be able to say, but there was nothing that stood out. Lily's clothes were neatly folded and placed beside where her body was found. Her handbag, which was still at the scene, had her purse with cash inside. Her savings book was in there, along with, I guess, something that was like a bank statement. This statement showed that Lily had over 1,000 kroner in the bank. 1,000 kroner now is about £75, but back in 1932, it was almost £4,500. So she had a lot of money, yet none of it was taken. Lily owned a lot of expensive possessions, such as her clothes, her jewellery, her radio, her phone, but again, they weren't stolen. So this essentially ruled out that robbery or monetary gain could have been the motive for this heinous murder. So what was the motive? Was it sexual? Was the killer a misogynist, someone who hated women? Was the killer someone who hated sex workers? Or was this yet another unfortunate case of a sex worker being killed while on the job? The murder weapon was never found and nothing was missing from inside the flat which resembled what Dr. Turnell believed the murder weapon could have been. So this told the investigators that the killer had brought it with him. This was a premeditated, targeted, cold, callous killing. 3 condom wrappers were found disposed of in a bin which were collected as evidence. They began to dust for fingerprints where they found probably hundreds. Lily brought her clients back to her own flat where she considered safe, and sometimes this could be upwards or even more than 5 men per night. She often had her many friends over, and so it was simply impossible for police to 1, collect and compare every single print that they found, and then 2, determine which of the prints belonged to the killer. It would be Lily's address book that gave the police their first proper leads. She was very meticulous keeping track of her clients, or her regular clients at least, their names, addresses, contact details, etc. So these were the men who police wanted to talk to first. They were able to track down 9 of the men from the address book, and these were all different types of men, ranging from CEOs to waiters to police officers. They were all completely different, having different backgrounds, different ways they met Lily, etc. All 9 of the men had no valuable information or anything that really aided police in their investigation, but at least now 9 of the men were ruled out as suspects. During door-to-door inquiries, investigators would be repeatedly told that tenants had neither seen or heard anything. Because it was Walpurgis night, it's safe to assume that many people were likely out and enjoying the celebrations. Ruth Johnson, who again is the landlord, would recall seeing several men coming in and out of the building, men who didn't live there. So this began the theory, had Lily accepted more clients? She did go to Minnie's twice, asking for more condoms. There were 3 packets found in her bin, but something that made this more credible was something that Minnie had noticed during their walk around the flat. She noticed that that bit of paper that Lily kept beside her phone with her phone number written down on it had been hidden away. If you remember, I said earlier, Lily would only hide it away from clients that she didn't care to see again. Maybe they made her feel uncomfortable or she just didn't like them. The reason this could support Lily having another client is because the man who rang when both Minnie and Lily were sat in the flat obviously already had Lily's number, so she would have no reason to hide it away from him. He already knew it. And then there's the theory, had Lily gone out to the bonfire without Minnie, met a client, and then went back to the room with him? Who knows, but that was one of the more popular theories. During these inquiries, investigators got an interesting tip from a waitress who worked in the restaurant on the ground floor of the apartment building. She distinctly remembered a man coming in and ordering 2 steak dinners to go at around 9 p.m. on Walpurgis night. The reason she remembered him so distinctly was because he was using the exact same porcelain container that she knew Lily used. Lily regularly visited the restaurant and took out, so the waitress was familiar with her. Obviously, we know that Lily wouldn't have been the only person in Sweden with this container, but it just stuck out with the waitress. As far as I could find, any efforts made to try and find this man resulted in nothing. A woman who was described as, quote, drunken with the same profession as Lily, reported to police that she believed her husband could be responsible for Lily's murder. Her husband was a pimp known as Peterson, maybe that's his surname, and his wife said that on Walpurgis night he had came home covered in blood, but that he had made an obvious effort to try and clean it. Peterson was known to police and they arrested him and held him for 10 days till they were forced to release him. This came after one of his very questionable, shady business partners provided him with an alibi. Could this have been a possibility though? Could Lily have worked or previously worked under Peterson if he was a pimp? Could she have done something to upset him and so he retaliated in murdering her? 2 men that Lily was romantically involved with were questioned. The first was Ragnar Nilsson, who had an on and off, quite rocky relationship with Lily, would be ruled out, and the next man would be a waiter who I couldn't find the name of. Minnie told officers that Lily secretly really, really liked this waiter, and when she was drunk, she would proclaim her love and attraction to him, but when she was sober, she would deny and retract it all, and it just went in a circle like that. After her murder, the waiter's brother, who I believe was from Copenhagen, asked Minnie to send him over some details about what had happened. Police tracked down the waiter, who had a solid alibi. He had been playing cards with his brothers and some female friends, all of which supported his alibi. Minnie didn't believe that the killer was either Ragnar or the waiter. I think that Minnie believed that the killer was the man who had rang up Lily. It couldn't have been any of these men because she would have recognised their voice, whereas she didn't recognise the man on the phone. I didn't know whether to mention what I'm about to say or not because it was later determined to be unrelated, but I know that I like to know as much as possible about cases and I figure that you do as well. So on the morning after the murder, this would be the 1st of May, a woman who was sleeping inside of her flat, which is within Lily's building, was awoken by a young man trying to break into her storage closet. This woman screams in fear and the man tries to cover her mouth to muffle her screams, but she was able to give him the slip and run out to the street calling for help. An officer on patrol heard the cries and raced to the woman, who led him back to where the attempted break-in was, but by now, the young man was long gone. This woman would describe him, saying that he couldn't have been any older than a teenager, and that he was wearing a suit minus a hat and coat. There were a handful of reasons that this attempted break-in wasn't linked to Lily's murder. Firstly, this young man is trying to break into a storage closet, probably to steal whatever is inside, yet Lily's killer had left behind loads of expensive stuff. If these were the same person, why would he leave behind cash, a radio, jewellery to try and break into a closet when he doesn't even know if there's anything inside that's worth taking? This boy was seemingly quite young and Lily's killer was presumed to be a bit older, hence a bit stronger, because of the extent of her injuries. So because of these reasons, the break-in was determined to be just a coincidence and unrelated to the murder. 6 weeks later, there would be a discovery that completely changed the case forever. Outside of the apartment building, there was a ladle, like the one you'd use to scoop up some gravy and put on your dinner. This ladle was found disposed of outside of the apartment building, and it had a reddish-brown stain on it, something that resembled blood. Once the press got a hold of this, they started to claim that this was the murder weapon, that the killer had drained the blood from Lily and used this ladle to drink the blood. Shortly after, the killer would be dubbed the Atlas Vampire. Just to poke some holes in that theory, the ladle couldn't have possibly been the murder weapon, as it was way too light to have caused a skull to cave in. We don't exactly know what the reddish brown stain was, but remember, there is a restaurant on the ground floor, so this could have been from an array of different sauces or condiments. Maybe the restaurant had chucked out the ladle and it fell from a bin or whatever, and that's how it got to the outside of the apartment building. The newspapers, though, weren't letting go of the idea that the monster who had murdered Lily was a blood-sucking vampire. It was making the papers fly off the shelves, so they continued to sell this story that they had created. Only a couple of years prior, in 1929, there was a German serial killer named Peter Curtin, and he was the headline of every newspaper, and he was dubbed the Vampire of Dusseldorf. This was after he admitted to drinking blood from his victims, and the iconic 1931 film Dracula was released shortly after Peter Curtin's crimes. The film blew up and it was so popular, and there was a lot of vampire-esque movies that came out following this, so you can see why many people were quick to jump the gun believing that Lily's killer was a vampire. Vampires were all the rage at the time. It is reported in many more recent articles that this ladle was found alongside Lily's body inside of her apartment. However, older Swedish articles don't state that, so that's what I'm going with. That's just a heads up in case you want to go ahead and do some more of your own research. You might see that reported, but like I say, I'm going to go with the older Swedish articles. Following this, Lily's case sadly went cold. Police were sure that her killer would strike again and maybe leave some sort of indication of who he was behind, but he never did, at least not in their jurisdiction. They had what we would now consider a gold mine of evidence in the semen and the saliva DNA, but this is in 1932. They weren't even close to having any sort of DNA or forensic technology. I tried to dig to see if any of the DNA that they had could be used now, and this is what I found. Quote, "Modern advances in DNA testing offer a glimmer of hope in potentially solving this cold case. However, the degradation of evidence over time and the absence of any suspect or family DNA in databases continue to hinder resolution." Lily Lindstrom's body was returned to her family in Malmö and she was buried in the Eastern Cemetery on the 16th of May 1932. Evidence including a lock of Lily's hair and the condom wrappers were displayed in the Stockholm Police Museum alongside a floor plan of the flat. There have been several theories over the year about who murdered Lily Lindstrom. Some believe that it could have been a police officer that she got on the wrong side of and that the whole investigation was just for show. Others think that maybe it was a doctor or some sort of other medical professional that could have committed the murder. Draining the blood from the body without leaving a single traceable mark isn't something that a regular Joe could do, but maybe a doctor could. And of course, the prevailing theory that you will hear and see over and over if you do look into this case more is that Lily was the victim of a blood-sucking vampire. I'm not sure what I think. This case definitely has a lot more questions than answers, and it's truly devastating that Lily, a 31-year-old woman in her prime who was just trying to survive, was horrifically murdered, and that her killer went without seeing justice. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please make sure to leave me a nice review and to follow the podcast wherever you're listening. I would appreciate that so much. You can follow the podcast over on Instagram at TrueCrimeCaitlinPod, where I'll be posting images relating to all of the cases and for any updates. There won't be a new podcast episode next week as I will be enjoying half term with my son, but I will see you all the week after.